And it hits me, oh my gosh, this is that triangle.
You know, there's explanation for everything that occurred in the Rendlesham Forest incident that doesn't involve aliens at all.
It was completely silent. It comes right over our heads.
He saw a classic flying saucer, really, standing in a clearing.
He turned over to my father and held his hand, and he looked in his eyes and he said, "We're not alone."
Hello and welcome to the show. I'm Martin Willis. Today's guest is Robert Schroeder. We talk about his book, which is Solving the UFO Enigma, How Modern Physics is Revealing the Technology of UFOs. It's a very sciencey show today. I hope you enjoy it. Oh, yes, and Michael Lauck will not be joining us today. He's got some things going on. So I have dragged in our Facebook page mogul or queen, call her what you'd like, Peggy Shunning. How are you, Peggy?
Hi, Martin. I'm good.
I thought I'd drag you in today and, you know, fill up
you
a little
time. You dragged me right out of my swimming pool.
Yeah, but this time I didn't wake you up at 8 o'clock in the morning and without
True.
Coffee. Yeah, so you had the day in front of you. And I have to fill up an entire hour, and I wasn't prepared for Michael to ditch me this week. So you're dragged in. You are the pinch hitter, and I know you love to complain, so what are we going to complain about today?
So hit it. Well, does it have to be podcast related, or can I complain about the weather or my car or my kids?
It sort of has to relate a little bit to the show. We're going to lose.
All right.
I mean, I can hear people unplugging their iPods right now.
Okay.
All right. So let's talk about UFOs. I want to talk about the Facebook page because you and I have this little, like, silent rant we do sometimes about the Facebook page. And you know, granted, isn't there like 5,800 people liked on that right now?
There are.
Yeah, something like that. It's almost 5,900.
5,895.
Wow. So, yeah. And that's a lot. But what I really want to talk about is it's almost like a science experiment. When we do postings, or I should say you do postings for a day or so, these people react to the photos. And what I want to say is, of course, if we're insulting anyone that comes to us on our Facebook page, we're not insulting you because you made it this far. But I'd say 90% or maybe even 99% of the people on our Facebook page have absolutely no idea we have a podcast.
You know, you wonder, don't you? Because I'll post links to the podcast or Michael's great, great blogs, and there's almost no comment on it. Yet I can post a cartoon that, of course, you don't have to click on a link and go someplace else, and I'll get, 5,000 likes.
Well, I remember this is just a case in point. And again, if we're insulting anyone out there, we're not really insulting you because you made it this far.
No, it's just social commentary.
Yes, that's right. Now, like, for instance, you posted a picture of Superman or something on Michael's blog, which had kind of had to do with the body of his blog, and people started talking about Superman.
I know.
They don't get past the pictures.
It was about pop culture dictating how we view UFOs and alien encounters, and how, in pop culture, Superman was one of the first aliens, Buck Rogers, yet our memories don't use, when people try to say, well, we see gray aliens because that's in the culture, communion. That's what we're programmed to see. Well, it's not true because we'd be seeing people like Buck Rogers and Superman. So I posted a picture of Superman next to the gray alien, underneath the link to Michael's blog about this. And you're right. We got comments on the pictures.
On Superman, yeah. People don't go past the pictures, but
yeah.
Again, there are exceptions to that. I mean, every once in a while, someone will post, a great podcast or something like that. So there are people that actually, it's kind of like salmon swimming up the stream. A couple of them make it and spawn.
It's a double-edged sword because, they might be talking total non sequiturs to what I've posted a link to.
Yeah.
But at least they're posting.
There is some interaction.
Yes.
We've got to say that.
Yes.
But I think we should really do some great science experiments with this and just see what happens. And I'm not really
sure.
I
should make links that are totally inappropriate for
it goes to porn or something.
Not lewd or something.
Yeah.
Better not do that. But maybe to a you know, I'll put a picture of the Enterprise and a link to a chocolate cake recipe.
Well, yeah, then we'll be responsible for people gaining weight. I don't know if I'd go
no,
that
no,
far.
No. Then we'd see how many have
people
actually
say,
clicked on the link.
Yeah. I want to tell the listening audience something that you said to me, I don't know, maybe a week ago. You decided that you're going to be a ufologist.
Oh, yes.
Self-proclaimed.
Yes.
Because you've been at this so long, right? And you've been very involved in it.
You were calling someone a researcher, and I'm sure they were, and I won't say who it was, but it was recent. And I thought, what does it take to be a researcher? Let me see. I've been looking into this for over 30 years. I've read practically every book on the subject. I've seen every video there is to see. I've been to four or five symposiums. I belong to the, Bud Hopkins Intruder Foundation. And I was talking to my husband. He's got his master's degree. And I said, what do you have to be, you know, considered a researcher? He said, well, you got to do this. He said, have you done field work? I said, yes, I have. I went to Pine Bush several times to do on-the-ground research. And he said, well, have you, you have to be published. And I said, well, I wrote a blog for Martin.
That's true.
Ergo, yeah. Drum roll, I can be considered a UFO researcher. I rest my case.
All right. So if anyone has had UFO problems, please contact Peggy. She's right on our Facebook page. You can just message her there.
Yeah, you can put that next to my little fake bio on the podcast page.
UFO problems solved, maybe.
Yeah.
Something like that.
Along with cooking and decorating tips and astrophysics, I also solve UFO problems.
That's right. Hey, I got to tell our listening audience about there. You better not mess around in this ufology field because Peggy is a super spy, a super
I am. I'm
PI,
a sleuth.
Private eye.
You know how that happened? I think I used to be a branch manager for a finance company.
Hmm.
And we had to track deadbeats.
Ah, wow.
And
it's kind of comes up in the same sentence now.
Well, it does, because so then I learned how to track people down, and I am like a dog with a bone.
Oh, I remember I put you on something one time, and you would not give up.
No.
Oh, I remember who it is. Yeah, I'm not even going to say who it is, but you found out all kinds of information about that person that's virtually unfindable.
Right. Well, there's nothing. I don't think there's anything you can't find on the internet just about.
Yeah, but I mean, you actually found true information, which is...
I know.
Yeah.
Well, you can. Amazing. Well, it's like that Colin Sanders, the man who had the triangle sighting in England.
Yes. I'm going to try to get him on. I listened to that whole interview. It was great.
I was trying to, search him. I was going through phone books in England and pulling up all the Colin Sanders and every Colin Sanders on Facebook. And I thought his description and the video and the visuals that he made was one of the best UFO sighting reports I'd ever seen.
I know the visuals. He makes these models of this.
Yes, the sightings. working models.
So anyone out there, if you need some UFO sleuthing, Peggy can do that for you.
Right.
She's
just
reasonable.
Small fee.
Reasonable. Yes. Yeah. All right, Peggy. Thanks so much. We're running out of time. We filled up some
space
here.
Well, you're welcome, Martin.
Thank you. And just to let everyone know, the music we play on the show is by Kerry Whitehouse. He composed the music. And another fan of the show, Moot Davis, who does more or less country western, and gave us the following new release, which is called 25 Lights. We're going to play that between now and our guest today, who is Robert Schroeder. Well, this song, 25 Lights, was inspired by the Marfa Texas Lights, and you can find him at mootdavis.com. Thanks again, Peggy.
You're welcome. Take care.
All right. We'll talk soon.
Well, I don't know what they want, but it might be you on the dark side of the moon, baby, slaving all the time. Ever since the day they took us in, we had to leave Earth behind. 25 lives. The most. I'll take a space hammer, baby. I'll kill whoever get close. Then we'll make a break fold and try to call coast to coast. 25 lights that came from the sky are parked in a crater, baby, right in front of you and I.
How you doing, Rob?
Terrific, Martin, and thank you for having me on the show.
You know, it's great. Man. You live half an hour from my office, so here we are face to face. It's always best to do an interview like that, and I appreciate you coming over.
I much prefer to do it face to face. I've even driven all the way to northern New Jersey in preference for doing face to face rather than on the telephone.
Well, that's great. Well, thank you, and. Your book that you were nice enough to send me, that's one of the pluses of doing this show is I get a lot of books in the mail. And I got your book, and it's Solving the UFO Enigma, How Modern Physics is Revealing the Technology of UFOs. Wow, that's a great title. Can you first of all talk about your background and what got you interested in UFOs?
Okay, I sure will. What actually happened, Martin, was... I come from a family of scientists and engineers, so I love science, I love technology. And what happened is in 1957 when I was a kid, I was only 11 years old, and I was standing out in my yard in Teaneck, New Jersey, northern New Jersey, just a couple miles west of New York City. It was a perfectly clear day, about 5 p.m., and I looked up in the sky early November 1957, and I saw this cylindrical-shaped object going across the sky. And directly behind it was a round object that was no wider than the narrow width of the cylinder. And the cylinder, if I had some way of describing it, I would say it looked like a cigarette, but it was metallic-looking and gold in color. And these two objects were obviously in tandem, and they were heading straight toward Manhattan. And we were only 2 miles west of Manhattan in Teaneck, New Jersey, northern Jersey. And eventually they disappeared over the trees. But years later, I read that November 1957, and for people who have been following the UFO phenomenon over the years, they will know that November 1957 was one of the biggest UFO waves in the United States that has ever been recorded. And I then, some years later, when I got older into my teens, I borrowed a book from the Teaneck Library, and I read this story about a guy in France who was walking his dog early in the morning, and he looked up, it was like 2 a.m. in the morning, so it was pitch black. He looked up and he saw this bright object, like a cylindrical shaped object, metallic, and it was, he said, at 3,000 or 4,000 feet up. And he said it was gigantic. He said it was easily half a mile long. And he couldn't figure out what the heck this was. And then he said it tilted on its side to maybe 45 degrees. And as he's standing there with his dog, he's looking at this thing, and all of a sudden there was a flash of light at the bottom end of the cylinder. And it was squared off on both ends, just like the object that I had seen. And a disc-shaped UFO popped out the bottom. And it swirled around the cylinder a couple times. Exactly, a mothership, and the disc shaped object shot off in one direction. Then a second one came out, shot off in a different direction, until about six or seven of these disc shaped typical flying saucers had popped out of the bottom of this thing and gone to the different directions of the compass.
Kind of like a Roman candle.
Yeah, almost, yeah. And yeah. What I realized, I made the connection to what I had seen. And the round object that was in tandem behind the thing in New Jersey had to have been a flying saucer, a disc, seen from below. I couldn't tell whether it was a sphere or a disc. But in retrospect, I realized that was the mothership. And this was one of the disc-shaped objects that must be stacked up like plates inside these cylinders. And wow, that's what got me into the UFO phenomenon and researching it all these years.
Was your family together during that sighting?
And I have five brothers and sisters. And toward the end of that sighting, I ran inside, and I did get two of my brothers to come out. The sisters weren't interested.
Now, and, did your father try to explain it away, or did, when you talked about it?
I did talk to my dad. My dad was a graduate of MIT, a research chemist, so we come from that kind of a family. His dad was like a mechanical engineer, so it goes through the generations. And but anyway, I did talk to him about it, but he pretty much dismissed it. You know, I think he patted me on the head and said, have another glass of milk.
Yeah, yeah. Tell us more about your background in general.
Okay. Yep. Martin, I went to Rutgers University in New Jersey, and I was a math major, and I also have a degree in aerospace engineering. And then I have an MBA on top of all that. Wow. I worked for Hewlett-Packard for 26 years, and I was in product management and operations, things like that. I retired a couple years ago, and after I retired, I'd been interested in the UFO phenomenon my entire life. I had been kind of following it, I've been reading physics and over the years for the last several decades, even before I retired, way before I retired. And I had an idea that what was going on in modern physics looked like it might explain the UFO phenomenon. And that's the reason I ended up writing the book. And I'm very, very interested in getting the word out on this, because I want to attract the attention of specialists in spectrography to help UFO researchers get spectrographic data from UFOs, because if we can get that kind of data, I believe we will see a certain type of radiation from UFOs, and that will pretty much virtually confirm the kind of technology that they're using and how it relates to what's going on in cutting-edge physics today.
You know? Wow. I know I talked about this a couple of podcasts back, and you know of Doug Trumbull.
Yeah.
And he has one of those right in his Hummer, right?
Well, he does have equipment, but it's mainly optical spectrum. And unfortunately, the data we need is much more in the invisible spectrum, so like gamma rays and X-rays. And I have been in contact with Doug Trumbull. He doesn't, he pretty much stays away from the UFO, although he's looking for data from the UFO, from actual UFO sightings. As far as the UFO community goes, yes. He's kind of careful about getting involved with the UFO community.
Is that why he never returns my email?
That's undoubtedly it. I think the reason is he really wants to focus on the scientific aspects. And unfortunately, as you probably know, there's an awful lot of distractions in the UFO field where a lot of people are, you know, claiming to have been abducted, or, you know, they have mental telepathy with the UFOs and stuff like that. A lot of that stuff can't be really proven, certainly not easily. On the other hand, If you can get spectrographic data and good photographic data, that's something really solid, and it's repeatable with many different if you have multiple UFO sightings, you can get that kind of data repeatedly. And so I think he sort of wants to kind of focus more on the scientific, the data side.
I think a lot of people in the UFO community would agree with that and go along with any type of scientific research that could be done.
Yeah, and a person that I have an enormous amount of respect for is Leslie Kane, and who you interviewed at the conference down in
South Carolina.
But anyway, Leslie really makes an effort just to stick to the more credible stuff, and I'm just really excited to see a journalist of her caliber come into the field of UFO research and really concentrate on the good data, and I hope that the efforts that she's making will eventually help to get the establishment scientific community to kind of come take a good look at this UFO phenomenon to help UFO researchers get the data that we need to get.
I certainly would be on 100% support of that myself.
Yeah,
I think that's wonderful. Unfortunately, with our timing here, I didn't get a chance to read your book, and thank you for sending it, by the way, but I didn't get into it, and I will read your book, definitely. But can you kind of go over the synopsis of what you go through in your book?
Okay, I sure can, Martin. And maybe I can just, I know because we don't have too much time, I'll just kind of get right to it. Yeah. The thing about the UFO phenomenon is that there's really two big questions on UFO technology. And number one, how do they get here? Undoubtedly, they're coming from other star systems. And number two, how are these craft able to perform inertia-defying acrobatics in our atmosphere? And when I say that, that word inertia is very important. Pilots, fighter pilots, can only withstand G-forces of maybe 8 or 9 G's, and they have to have a G suit on, and they really have to train for that sort of thing. But somehow these UFOs are able to accelerate literally at speeds they've been clocked on radar of 100 G's or better, and which would turn a ordinary pilot in a plane into a pancake. And so,
or any object in the plane.
Yes, that's right. And the plane itself would be shredded. And somehow these UFOs are overcoming inertial forces. And that's very, very important. So the two big things about UFOs are, number one, how do they get here? And number two, how they overcome inertial forces. And I thought I'd focus on how they get here first, and that's the exciting part, and it'll explain why we need spectrographic data as I get to the end of this. But can I just go ahead and jump right in?
Mm-hmm.
Okay. Well, we unfortunately have to do a little bit of physics. That's the bad news, but the good news is there won't be any quizzes or tests. The universe is actually quite simple. There's really not much to the basic constituents of the universe. There's only really three components. There's matter particles, like electrons and protons, things like that. There's force particles that carry the forces, the fundamental forces of nature, of which there are only four. For example, you have electromagnetism, which is carried by the photon, and you have the strong nuclear force, which is carried by a particle called a gluon. Then you have the weak nuclear force, which is carried by particles called the W plus, W minus, and Z neutral bosons. Boson is a term physicists use to describe a force particle. And then the hypothetical particle called the graviton, which carries the gravity force. So there's only four fundamental forces. And then on the matter side, on the matter particles, there's only a couple of matter particles. There's electrons, which people are familiar with, then there's protons in the nucleus of an atom and neutrons. But the protons and the neutrons are actually made up of smaller particles called quarks, Q-U-A-R-K-S. And there's only really two basic types of quarks that are in 99.9999% of all matter, and those are the up quark and the down quark. And that's it. The electron, the up quark and the down quark, and another particle, a ghostly particle called a neutrino, and that pretty much comprises all the matter that in the universe. There does happen to be additional families of particles that are just higher energy versions of those four that I just mentioned, of the matter particles. But for our purposes, you can think of the universe as very, very simple. So basically, the four fundamental forces of nature, gravity, electromagnetism, the weak nuclear force, and the strong nuclear force. The strong nuclear force holds the nucleons, the particles in the nucleus, together. And the weak nuclear force is responsible for radioactivity. And electromagnetism is what holds the electron in orbit around the nucleus of the atom. And then gravity is responsible, of course, for making us want to stay in bed in the morning. Those are the four fundamental forces, and I mentioned the fundamental matter particles too. And here's where it gets interesting. It's unfortunate that I have to kind of go through the physics, but what I have to say after this won't make sense unless I explain things.
Sure.
And one more thing I had to mention: there are three basic components to the universe. There's the matter particles, force particles, and there's space-time. Whatever space-time is, nobody quite knows what it is, but space-time is the fabric of space-time, is the stage on which matter particles and force particles interact with each other, and they create everything we see around us, everything we see, all the buildings, the cars, the planets, the stars, everything. And so it's just those three simple basic components. But now science or physicists are particularly interested in the force particles, the forces of nature. And the reason is because the forces of nature are what make things happen, like the lightning bolt in an electrical storm. And so it turns out that there are certain symmetries among the forces that make physicists believe that way, way back at the beginning of the universe, at the time of the Big Bang, that the four forces of nature were united in a single force called the superforce. That's what they referred to it as. Mm-hmm. And if people wonder what physicists are doing, a lot of the work that they do, in fact, a great deal of it, probably the majority of it, is aimed at trying to reconstruct both theoretically and experimentally that early universe when the four forces were united as a superforce. You can sort of think of it as the holy grail of modern physics, to unite those four fundamental forces. And they have made some progress. They've managed to reunite the electromagnetic force with the weak nuclear force, and that's referred to as the electroweak force. And they've actually seen this electroweak force in particle accelerators. They've actually recreated it. They're also working on reuniting the strong nuclear force, both theoretically anyway, with the electroweak force. And that is referred to as that combined force is referred to as the GOOT, Grand Unified Theory. They haven't been able to prove it yet, but they seem to be making some theoretical progress on that. But there's one huge problem that they're having is they can't get gravity into the mix. So far they've not been able to theoretically or experimentally unite gravity with the other three fundamental forces of nature.
It's funny you mention that. I want to just interject here. If you go back a few podcasts, I did a podcast with Thomas Fusco. He's a physicist in Florida. Have you heard his talk on the gravitons and all that?
I have. I think it's the guy that I'm thinking of. I was at the Kate Valentine show in New Jersey, and Kate mentioned that she had done a show with Thomas Fusco. Yep. Mm-hmm. So I've definitely heard of him.
Yeah.
Going back to what I was saying, the question is, why haven't they been able to get gravity into the mix of a kind of unified theory? It's actually referred to as the theory of everything, the TOE for short, as in big toe. they've not been able to theoretically somehow bring gravity into the mix to reunite these four fundamental forces. And the question is, why haven't they been able to include gravity in the mix? And here is the main reason why. It turns out that the gravity force is incredibly weak compared to the other forces of nature. Most people, you know, would, you know, tell you otherwise. They'd say, are you kidding?
I've heard that before.
You've heard that too. Mm-hmm. Yep. Most people would tend to believe that gravity is the strongest of all forces, but it's not. Admittedly, when we got to go to work in the morning and we're stumbling out of bed, it just seems totally overwhelming, you know. But in reality, the electromagnetic force, as an example, is 10 to the 36 times stronger than the gravity force. Wow. And the electromagnetic force is very similar in strength to the weak nuclear force and the strong nuclear force, so the non-gravity forces. So in other words, all three of the non-gravity forces are tremendously powerful compared to gravity. And that when I say 10 to the 36, that's equivalent to 1 followed by 36 zeros.
Right. Yeah.
You know, so like 10 squared is 100. You can imagine 1 followed by 36 zeros is a humongous number. Mm. And that is the main primary reason why physicists have not been able to get gravity into the mix theoretically or experimentally. And that weakness of gravity versus the other forces of nature is actually a problem in physics, because they have to be able to explain why the other forces of nature are so close in strength, but gravity is way out in left field. Mm-hmm. How come? Mm-hmm. And that problem is actually referred to as the hierarchy problem in physics. And it's one of the big question marks in modern physics that they're trying to resolve. Here's where it starts to get really exciting. The direction of modern physics is critical to explaining both the weakness of gravity and the UFO phenomenon, and I'll show you how. And this is very, very interesting, very fascinating. It turns out that the modern physics for years, right up until about the 1970s, so you can think of modern physics beginning with basically Isaac Newton with his laws of motion and his first explanation of gravity. Then along came James Clerk Maxwell and his explanation for the laws of electromagnetism. And then at the turn, and these are the really basic foundation stones of physics, of modern physics. And then along came, at the beginning of the 20th century, quantum mechanics and special relativity and general relativity. So these are the basic building blocks of modern physics, the theories that I just mentioned. But all these theories are built on the idea that the universe is four-dimensional, that is, three dimensions of space and one of time. And so that's where you get your four dimensions of space-time that everybody talks about these days. But starting in about the 1970s, and in the and you have to realize that in the background, physicists are striving to unite the four fundamental forces of nature. Well, around the 1970s, 1980s, there was a breakthrough. They suddenly realized after the from experimental data that it looked like the subatomic particles of nature, which had previously been thought to be dimensionless points, the experimental data was indicating that the subatomic particles were actually tiny wiggling strings with dimension, that is, they had length. And that was a shock. And that suddenly began to change the direction of physics. It was like an explosion of new theories that came out starting in the 70s and 80s. When they first came up with the idea of strings, which became something called string theory, that's the whole idea of these tiny wiggling strings that appear to be the building blocks of nature instead of dimensionless points. But it turned out that it required more than four dimensions. And eventually they realized it looked like it required a total of 11 dimensions.
Right. Yeah,
and that's exciting because the UFO phenomenon up until now, people have conjectured that the only way UFOs could get here through four-dimensional space was to travel in that four-dimensional space to other star systems, but would be limited by the speed of light. In fact, we couldn't even begin to approach the speed of light without having enormous amounts of energy expended. But now comes the possibility that there are extra dimensions which might change things. And that's what it looks like. And here's where the connection to the UFO phenomenon occurs. One of the theories that came out of string theory, and it's what followed string theory, was something called M theory, which is actually stands
for
membranes. Yeah. And they believe that we may live on a membrane, a space-time membrane that's floating in a larger dimensional space. And it looks like there may be two of these membranes, at least two, and the space between these membranes is referred to as the bulk, B-U-L-K. And one of the theories that came out of string M theory, one of the theories that was derived from string and M theory, is a theory called warped geometry, which attempts to explain the weakness of gravity. Here it is. And I want everybody in the audience to listen because this, I believe, is the key to how UFOs get to planet Earth from distant star systems. Here it is. It turns out that the space between the membranes out there is severely warped, according to this theory called warped geometry, developed by a Harvard physicist. And in fact, so severely warped that the number of gravitons that are located in this bulk increases exponentially the deeper you go into the bulk, to the point where the force of gravity increases to 10 to the 16 power, one followed by 16 zeros. In other words, it's so bone-crushingly strong that the force of gravity out there is just absolutely phenomenal. But that would explain the weakness of gravity. The vast majority of gravitons that carry the gravity force are in this bulk between the membranes. They're not on the space-time membrane that we live on. And here's the key to how UFOs get to planet Earth. A UFO, if it could get into that bulk area, if it could penetrate it, it would only have to go into the bulk a distance that's equivalent to where gravity in the bulk is only 1/10,000th the maximum strength of gravity in the bulk. And if it only got in that far, a UFO, and general relativity tells us that in a strong gravity field, distances shrink. The distance to Alpha Centauri, which is 25 trillion miles from planet Earth, which under normal circumstances would take thousands of years by rocket to get to, The distance to Alpha Centauri at that short, relatively short distance into the bulk shrinks to 25 miles.
Oh.
And there's the key. And that's how they're doing it. And in the book, I explain how they take care of time dilation, because general relativity tells us a strong gravity field, time slows down. And we don't really have enough time in this podcast to get into that. But the important thing is that the distance shrinks, and the UFOs are going into the, I believe, into the bulk, and that's how they're getting between the stars.
Would you theorize on how they would get into the bulk?
I will. That's a very good question. In fact, you're the first person that's asked that. And I've done dozens and dozens of interviews. I think I know how they get there. And it relates to, I believe, these UFOs are actually particle accelerators. And that's what I think they are. And that's why UFOs are always have a certain one particular structural aspect to all UFOs is they always have one part of the UFO that is circular. Think of flying saucers, think of cylinders, and even the triangle UFOs that they've been seeing, they see these bright circles in each corner, a very large circles. And I believe the reason for that is because these UFOs are actually particle accelerators. And here's where modern physics may reveal how UFOs work. I mean, they're not looking for anything about UFOs. Physicists will not touch the subject of UFOs. It's kind of like the third rail for them, you know, and they stay far away from it. But nevertheless, those of us who are interested in the UFO phenomenon, we can go ahead and make the connection between what's going on in modern physics and the UFO phenomenon. Well, I believe, not only myself, but the modern physics community believes that these particle accelerators, the Large Hadron Collider in Geneva, Switzerland, will be producing a type of particle called a KK graviton, which stands for a Kaluza-Klein graviton. As they smash protons head-to-head at almost the speed of light into each other, they expect to eventually create Kaluza-Klein gravitons. And these are going to be gravitons with mass, and they are actually a manifestation of the extra dimensions if they exist. And so the creation of Kaluza-Klein gravitons will be a confirmation that the extra dimensions exist. Here's where it gets also very, very interesting. The Kaluza-Klein gravitons are going to be so powerful, they're going to create such a powerful gravitational force up to 10 to the 16, just like I had mentioned where the bulk goes up to that strength, that they in turn will induce the creation of micro black holes. And these micro black holes, they'll definitely be able to detect them in the Large Hadron Collider, because the conservation of energy laws they'll have to see where all the energy of the collision goes. And if there's missing energy, that's an indication that unusual things are happening, like micro black holes or KK gravitons. Here's where it gets exciting. When I was reading about these stories about micro black holes being created by the Large Hadron Collider, my thought was, right away, I thought, well, wait a minute. Four-dimensional gravitons from planet Earth go at the speed of light. Everybody knows that, you know, gravitons go at the speed of light. And we know that photons that carry light rays go at the speed of light as well. And we also know that photons, light itself, will not be able, once it hits the escape horizon micro black hole, the event horizon, it will actually be swallowed by the micro black hole, and
just like a real black hole,
and micro black holes are real black holes, and I said to myself, hey, wait a minute, would four dimensional gravitons be swallowed by a micro black hole too? And so I got into an area of the web referred to as archive.org. Which is where physicists pre-published papers that they're doing. And of course, an awful lot of work was going on at the Large Hadron Collider, trying to figure out what's going to happen when these particles collide. And among the things they were looking at were micro black holes. So I did a couple of searches, and I said, 4D gravitons swallowed by micro black holes, stuff like that. And sure enough, I got papers back that were written where they said exactly that. And here's how UFOs work. This is how I think they work. These micro black holes, once they're, I think the UFOs create like an envelope around the UFO of micro black holes. And what the micro black holes do is the UFO itself generates gravitons, four-dimensional gravitons, that are exchanged with planet Earth. So it's hovering in the sky, and the Earth itself creates four-dimensional gravitons that carry the gravity force. And that exchange of gravitons between, like, an airplane and the planet Earth is what creates this warping of space where the plane is. But the more gravitons that are exchanged, the greater the force of gravity between objects that are in that warp space. And so it occurred to me that if the UFOs are swallowing these using the micro black holes to swallow four-dimensional gravitons, both from the UFO and from the planet Earth, then what ends up happening is the UFO becomes much, much lighter as far as the Earth is concerned. The Earth no longer sees a heavy object out there. Instead, it sees something that's much lighter. This is not anti-gravity. Physics, by the way, doesn't support the concept of anti-gravity. So this is perfect, because we don't want to use anti-gravity, because modern physics simply doesn't support the idea. And so instead, this is just simply reducing the gravity force to a very low level, so the object becomes very lightweight. And so many people have noticed that UFOs are spinning. They always report that either the outer rim of the UFO is spinning or the entire thing is spinning. And here's the reason why. Anybody who's ever used a frisbee, a lightweight frisbee, if you try to throw it across the yard, what do you have to do? You have to spin it, because otherwise it would become unstable. And the reason you have to spin it is because it's so light. And because it's so light, it's going to wobble and so on. And so by spinning it, you stabilize it, and that allows you to toss it across the yard. It's precisely the same reason why UFOs spin, because they're very lightweight. As far as the Earth is concerned, they have to spin for stability, and that's it.
One in particular, I had a sighting.
Okay.
But I saw like a perfectly round disc. I didn't notice spinning. How would you explain that?
It may have been spinning, but it might not have been noticeable, because the discs themselves are perfectly smooth. Mm-hmm. And so even if it's spinning, it might not necessarily be noticeable.
Might work for the case, in my case, possibly.
Okay, and another possibility, they may have like a ring on just on the inside of the skin that's spinning and that you wouldn't even see, and that would be hidden away.
Yep. Like a gyroscope.
Yep.
Like,
yep. Yeah. Yep.
You know. Uh-huh. And wow.
One of the things with micro black holes, if the UFOs are creating these micro black holes, which I think they are, the evidence that they are creating micro black holes would be something called Hawking radiation. When micro black holes decay, because they all decay very quickly, the small black holes decay very fast, they create something called Hawking radiation. And basically, Hawking radiation looks like a black body curve. For those in the audience who are familiar with physics, that looks like kind of a normal curve. And you have intensity on the y-axis and frequency on the x-axis. But anyway, the critical thing for the UFO researchers, and if we can get some help from the academic community, from expert specialists in spectrographic analysis and who know how to use the equipment and can have access to the equipment, which unfortunately is expensive, if we can get some field teams out there and Occasionally you have UFO waves like the Hudson Valley, mm-hmm. the Phoenix Lights, and the Belgian Triangles, where the UFOs appear repeatedly over a period of many months, sometimes even over more than a year. Then we have an opportunity in those waves to get field equipment out there and try to capture electromagnetic emissions from these UFOs. If we detect Hawking radiation, that would virtually confirm that they are using, KK gravitons, warp geometry, micro black holes, and that's the technology that they're using, which we here on planet Earth are right on the cusp of understanding ourselves. We have to, once the Large Hadron Collider produces micro black holes, will have seen them for the first time. And I want to add one more thing. What's very exciting about this is the UFO researchers could make a huge contribution to modern physics. Nobody has ever seen Hawking radiation, but virtually all physicists believe it's real. If UFO researchers were the first to detect Hawking radiation, it would be an enormous breakthrough in physics. And if we could duplicate it with multiple UFO sightings to confirm it, it would put UFO research on the map. And this is the part that excites me, and I hope that this podcast, somewhere out there in the ether, that some specialists in spectrographic analysis and who have access to and expertise in the use of spectrographic equipment, that they may hear this broadcast, and they can contact me through Amazon.com where they mention my email. And,
okay, also yeah. Someone could contact me as well and I could get in contact with you.
That would be terrific. Thank you, Martin, for that offering to help.
Yeah. Now,
there's one more thing that's very important that I forgot to mention earlier. A engineer by the name of Paul Hill, he was worked for NASA for many, many years. Back in between the 1950s and the 1970s, he was able to obtain data from UFO sightings, because they were very pronounced down around military bases back in between the 1950s and 1970s, more so than they are today. But he got Geiger counter readings from UFO sightings at many different bases. He had a team of people, scientists, engineers, and stuff that were helping him.
Wow.
And they detected, Martin, and this is the exciting thing, they detected gamma rays. That was one of the prominent emissions they were capturing from UFOs. Turns out that micro black holes, gamma rays are very prominent. In fact, when they decay, the final portion of their decay cycle, they decay in a burst of gamma rays. That's how Hawking radiation occurs. And so the fact that he picked up specifically gamma rays is a very good sign. It's already pointing toward the high likelihood that these craft are producing micro black holes to swallow four-dimensional gravitons. And one more piece of evidence, one more here is related to the emissions. They also picked up strong magnetic fields around UFOs. Well, pilots often report when UFOs come close to their aircraft, their magnetic compasses spin mm-hmm. wildly. Well, guess what? Micro black holes are theorized to have strong magnetic fields, extremely strong magnetic fields. Then there's one more piece of evidence. There's actually a few more, but one more that comes to mind. In California, back in the 1970s, Sonora, California, some people saw a substance called angel hair that was being emitted by the UFOs that was floating to the earth. And one of the witnesses managed to put some in a jar. And they took the jar with the angel hair in it, and they took it to a laboratory, and they found a isotope of hydrogen called tritium, which is highly radioactive. It decays, that is, very quick. And it turns out that tritium is only produced in large quantities, either in nuclear reactors or in particle accelerators.
Hmm.
And that's what I think UFOs are. I think they're particle accelerators. And here's tritium being apparently produced by these UFOs.
Wow. Now, was that the one where that it fell down on the tree?
Yes.
Yes.
Exactly. Yep. Yeah. You know your UFO history.
Yeah. Yeah. Okay. Well, just one more question I have. We're out of time here. But for you to take this seriously and do the research that you've been doing, have you taken any ridicule by your peers or anything from this, or your family even?
Well, occasionally my daughter jokes with me.
And does she have a scientific background herself?
She's a structural engineer.
Okay. Yeah.
And a very unusual for a woman to be in that field. She's one of the exceptions, a rare exception. And mm-hmm. and she always tells us stories when she goes to meetings that she is often the only female in a group of like 20 people.
Mm-hmm.
So, but I mean, she'll kid with me now and then. But she basically believes that something is going on, and my wife supports me 100%. My brothers support me totally because they have a scientific background and they understand what it is that I'm doing. You know, they understand the concepts that I'm talking about, and generally, most people when they hear the approach that I make, which is really based on getting evidence, and how I believe these things work, they generally listen. They're very respectful.
That's great.
Yeah, and I'm happy that I think we're maybe pulling the whole UFO research field more toward getting evidence and data, and away from anecdotal stories, which are important. The anecdotal stories are important, mm-hmm. but I want to get it more toward getting real solid data. That's one of my absolute primary goals.
That's wonderful. I back that 100%. Thank you so much. It's been a real pleasure.
Martin, thank you for having me on the show. I really appreciate it.